6. A dark river, perhaps a new life. At 1 a.m. on May 21st, 2000, Enrique waits on the edge of the water. "If you get caught, I don't know you," says El Tarindaro. He is stern. Enrique nods. So do two other migrants, a Mexican brother and sister, waiting with him. They strip to their underwear. Enrique has seen smugglers ask migrants to grab hold of a long rope to cross the river. Others lock arms and form a human chain. El Tarindaro's strategy is more risky. He uses a black inner tube, which is bulky and easy for border patrol agents to spot. Across the Rio Grande stands a 50-foot pole equipped with U.S. Border Patrol cameras. In daylight, Enrique has counted 4 sport utility vehicles near the pole, each with agents. Now in the darkness, he cannot see any. He leaves it up to El Tarindaro, who has spent hours at this spot studying everything that moves on the other side. Enrique tears up a small piece of paper and scatters it on the riverbank. It is his mother's phone number. He has memorized it. Now the agents cannot use it to locate and deport her. In all, Enrique has spent 4 months trying to find her. El Tarindaro holds an inner tube. The Mexicans climb on. He paddles them to an island in midstream. He returns for Enrique with the tube. He steadies it in the water. Carefully, Enrique climbs aboard. Up to 3 migrants have drowned in a single day along this stretch of river. The Rio Bravo, as it is called here, is swollen with rain, a torrent of water coursing toward the Gulf of Mexico. 2 nights ago, it killed a youngster he knew, a tall, skinny migrant with a cleft upper lip. A whirlpool pulled him under. The year is not yet half over. Already, 54 people have been pulled, lifeless, from the river at or near Nuevo Laredo. Enrique cannot swim, and he is afraid. El Tarindaro places a plastic garbage bag on Enrique's lap. It contains dry clothing for the 4 of them. Then El Tarindaro paddles and starts to push. A swift current grabs the tube and sweeps it into the river. Wind whips off Enrique's cap. Drizzle coats his face. He dips in a hand. The water is cold. He scans the murky water for the green snakes that sometimes skim across the waves. All at once, he sees a flash of white, one of the SUVs, probably with a dog in back, inching along a trail above the river. Silence. No bullhorn barks. Turn back. The inner tube lurches, sloshes, and bounces along. Enrique grips the valve stem. The sky is overcast, and the river is dark. In the distance, bits of light dance on the surface. At last, he sees the island overgrown with willows and reeds. He seizes the limb of a willow. It tears off. With both hands, he lays hold of a larger branch, and the inner tube swings onto the silt and grass. They have crossed the southern channel. On the other side of the island flows the northern channel, even more frightening because it is closer to the United States. El Tarindaro circles the island on foot and looks across the water. The white SUV reappears less than 100 yards away. It is moving slowly along the dirt trail high on the riverbank. Its roof lights flash red and blue on the water, creating a psychedelic sheen. Agents turn to aim a spotlight straight at the island. Enrique and the Mexicans dive to the ground face first. If the agents spot them and lie in wait, it could spell doom for Enrique. He is closer to his mother than ever. Authorities can deport the Mexicans back across the river, but they can send him all the way to Honduras. Worse, he could sit in a Texas jail cell for months before the United States processed the paperwork to deport him. Most likely the juvenile prison in Liberty, Texas, 46 miles northeast of Houston, where many minors who are captured in Texas, trying to enter the United States alone and illegally, are sent to await deportation. Immigrant children arrive at the jail shackled. They are strip-searched and asked to squat and cough, an exercise to determine if they are harboring any contraband items in certain cavities of their bodies. They file through 8 locked metal doors to arrive at the E-pod, where immigrant children as young as 12 are held. They are housed at times in the same pod with accused rapists and other felons. Children in the E-pod spend most of their time inside windowless cells that measure 7.5 by 10 feet. Migrant children say the jail, operated by Corrections Corporation of America, doesn't feed them enough. Without cash to buy from the jail's commissary, they go hungry and lose weight. They see sunlight 1 hour a day when they are allowed into an outdoor area surrounded by a fence topped with concertina wire. They have little information about when they might be brought before an immigration judge or deported. The guards know little, and most do not speak Spanish. Locked up day after day, month after month, the children grow desperate. They run circles around their tiny cells. They read the instructions on the shampoo label over and over. Some become fearful they will go crazy in the jail. They begin to talk to themselves. One boy gets so depressed he stops eating for days and bangs his knuckles against the concrete wall until they are raw. A few of the children become suicidal and try to hang themselves. If he was lucky, Enrique would spend no more than 2 or 3 months locked up before being sent back to Honduras. It would mean starting out for the 9th time. For half an hour on the river's island, everyone lies stone still. Crickets sing, and water rushes around the rocks. Finally, the agents seem to give up. El Tirindaro waits and watches. He makes certain, then returns. Enrique whispers, "Take the others first." El Tirindaro loads the Mexicans onto the tube. Their weight sinks it almost out of sight. Slowly, they lumber across the water. Minutes later, El Tirindaro returns. "Get over here," he says to Enrique. "Climb up." He has other instructions. Don't rustle the garbage bag holding the clothes. Don't step on twigs. Don't paddle. It makes noise. El Tirindaro slips into the water behind the tube and kicks his legs beneath the surface. It takes only a minute or two. He and Enrique reach a spot where the river slows, and Enrique grabs another branch. They pull ashore and touch soft, slippery mud. In his underwear, Enrique stands for the first time on U.S. soil. Nearly frozen. As El Tirindaro hides the inner tube, he spots the border patrol. He and the 3 migrants hurry along the edge of the Rio Grande to a tributary called Sacate Creek. "Get in," El Tirindaro says. Enrique walks into the creek. It is cold. He bends his knees and lowers himself to his chin. His broken teeth chatter so hard they hurt. He cups a hand over his mouth, trying to stop them. For an hour and a half, they stand in Sacate Creek in silence. Effluent spills into the water from a 3-foot-wide pipe close by. It is connected to a sewage treatment plant on the edge of Laredo, Texas. Enrique can smell it. El Tirindaro walks ahead, scouting as he goes. At his command, Enrique and the others climb out of the water. Enrique is numb. He falls to the ground, nearly frozen. "Dress quickly," El Tirindaro says. Enrique steps out of his wet undershorts and tosses them away. They are his last possession from home. He puts on dry jeans, a dry shirt, and his 2 left shoes. El Tirindaro offers everyone a piece of bread and a soda. The others, hidden in a thicket of bushes, eat and drink. Enrique is too nervous. Being on the outskirts of Laredo means they are near homes. If dogs bark, the border patrol will suspect intruders. "This is the hard part," El Tirindaro says. He runs. Enrique races behind him. The Mexicans follow up a steep embankment, along a well-worn dirt path, past mesquite bushes and behind some tamarind trees, until they are next to a large, round, flat tank. It is part of the sewage plant. Beyond is an open space. El Tarindaro glances nervously to the right and left. Nothing. "Follow me," he says. Now he runs faster. Numbness washes out of Enrique's legs. It disappears in a wave of fear. They sprint next to a fence, then along a narrow path on a cliff above the creek. They dash down another embankment, into the dry upstream channel of Sacate Creek, under a pipe, then a pedestrian bridge across the channel, up the opposite embankment, and out onto a two-lane residential street. Two cars pass. Winded, the four scuttle into bushes. Half a block ahead, a car flashes its headlights. Puffs of clouds. It is a red Chevrolet Blazer with tinted windows. "Let's go," El Tarindaro says. As they reach it, locks click open. Enrique and the others scramble inside. In front sit a Latino driver and a woman, part of El Tarindaro's smuggling network. Enrique has met them before, on the other side of the river. It is 4 a.m. Enrique is exhausted. He climbs onto pillows in back. They are like puffs of clouds, and he feels immense relief. He smiles and says to himself, "Now that I'm in this car, no one can get me out." The engine starts and the driver passes back a pack of beer. He asks Enrique to put it into a cooler. The driver pops a top. For a moment, Enrique worries, what if the driver has too many? The Blazer heads toward Dallas. Border patrol agents pay attention to Blazers, other SUVs, and vans. Some smugglers favor windowless vans. They strip out the back seats and stack the migrants like cordwood, one on top of the other. Headlights tilted up mean there are people in the back, weighing down the vehicle, says Alexander D. Hernandez, a supervisor in Catula, Texas. Weaving means the load is heavy and causing sway. When the agents notice, they pull alongside and shine a flashlight into the eyes of the passengers. If the riders do not look over but seem frozen in their seats, they are likely to be illegal immigrants. Enrique sleeps until El Tarindaro shakes him. They are out of Laredo and half a mile south of a border patrol checkpoint. "Get up," El Tarindaro says. Enrique can tell he has been drinking. Five beers are gone. The Blazer stops. Enrique and the two Mexicans, with El Tarindaro leading, climb a wire fence and walk east, away from the freeway. Then they turn north, parallel to it. Enrique can see the checkpoint at a distance. "Every car must stop. U.S. citizens?" agents ask. Often they check for documents. Enrique and his group walk 10 minutes more, then turn west, back toward the freeway. They crouch next to a billboard. Overhead, the stars are receding, and he can see the first light of dawn. The Blazer pulls up. Enrique sinks back into the pillows. He thinks, "I have crossed the last big hurdle." Suddenly, he is overwhelmed. Never has he felt so happy. He stares at the ceiling and drifts into a deep, blissful sleep. 400 miles later, the Blazer pulls into a gas station on the outskirts of Dallas. Enrique awakens. El Tarindaro is gone. He has left without saying goodbye. From conversations in Mexico, Enrique knows that El Tarindaro gets $100 a client. Enrique's mother, Lourdes, has promised $1,200. The driver is the boss. He gets most of the money. The Patero is on his way back to Mexico. Along with fuel, the driver buys more beer, and the Blazer rolls into Dallas about noon. America looks beautiful. The buildings are huge. The freeways have traffic exchanges with double and triple decks. They are nothing like the dirt streets at home. Everything is clean. The driver drops off the Mexicans and takes Enrique to a large house. Inside are bags of clothing in various sizes and American styles to outfit clients so they no longer stand out. They telephone his mother. Lourdes. Lourdes, now 35 years old, has come to love North Carolina. People are polite. There are plenty of jobs for immigrants, and it seems to be safe. She can leave her car unlocked as well as her house. Her daughter Diana quickly masters English, something she hadn't done surrounded by Spanish speakers in California. Lourdes is always thinking about the two children she left in Honduras. When she walks by stores that sell things they might like, she thinks of Enrique and Belki. When she meets a child Enrique's age, she tells herself, Así debe estar mi muchachito. My little boy must look this big now. A small gray album holds treasures and painful memories. Pictures of Belki, her daughter back home. At 7, Belki wears a white First Communion dress and long white gloves. At 9, a yellow cheerleader's skirt. At 15, for her quinceañera, a pink taffeta dress with lace sleeves and white satin shoes. Belki leans over a two-layer cake topped with white frosting and a pink angel. Lourdes spent $700 to make the party special. She promised Belki she would try to make it back to Honduras for the big event somehow. I wanted to go. I wanted to go, Lourdes says. At 18, Belki wears a blue gown and mortarboard for her high school graduation. There are pictures of Enrique, too. At 8, in a tank top, with 4 piglets at his feet. At 13, in the photograph, at Belki's quinceañera, the serious-looking little brother. She most treasures a photo of her son in a pink shirt. It is the only one she has where he is smiling. She has often worried from afar about her boy. In 1999, a sister in Honduras disclosed the truth about Enrique. He's getting in trouble. He's changed. He was smoking marijuana. The news made Lourdes sick. Her stomach tightened into a knot for a week. Now she is more worried than ever. Lourdes has not slept. All night since Enrique's last call from a payphone across the Rio Grande, she has been having visions of him dead, floating on the river, his body wet and swollen. She told her boyfriend, "My greatest fear is never to see him again." She has spent part of the night in her kitchen, praying before a tall candle adorned with the image of San Judas Tadeo. This saint tackles difficult situations, matters of life and death. Lourdes lit the candle days ago when Enrique made his first phone call from Nuevo Laredo. Each time Lourdes walks past the candle, she prays. God has granted to you the privilege of aiding humankind in the most desperate cases. Oh, come to my aid that I may praise the mercies of God. All my life I will be your grateful client until I can thank you in heaven. Now a female smuggler is on the phone. The woman says, "We have your son in Texas, but $1,200 is not enough. $1,700. Lourdes grows suspicious. Maybe Enrique is dead and the smugglers are trying to cash in. Put him on the line, she says. He's out shopping for food, the smuggler replies. Lourdes will not be put off. He's asleep, the smuggler says. How can he be both? Lourdes demands to talk to him. Finally, the smuggler gives the phone to Enrique. Sos tú? His mother asks anxiously. Is it you? Sí, mami, it's me. Still, his mother is not sure. She does not recognize his voice. She has heard it only half a dozen times in 11 years. Sos tú, she asks again, then twice more. She grasps for something, anything, that she can ask this boy, a question that no one but Enrique can answer. She remembers what he told her about his shoes when he called on the payphone. What kind of shoes do you have on, she asks. 2 left shoes, Enrique says. Fear drains from his mother like a wave back into the sea. It is Enrique. She feels pure happiness. Waiting. She takes $500 she has saved, borrows $1,200 from her boyfriend, and wires it to Dallas. In the house with the clothing, the smugglers wait. From the bags, Enrique puts on clean pants, a shirt, and a new pair of shoes. The smugglers take him to a restaurant. He eats chicken smothered in cream sauce. Clean, sated, in his mother's adopted country, he is happy. They go to Western Union, but there is no money under his mother's name, not even a message. How could she do this? At worst, Enrique figures he can break away, run. But the smugglers call again. She says she has sent the money through a female immigrant who lives with her, because the woman gets a Western Union discount. The money should be there under the woman's name. It is. Enrique has no time to celebrate. The smugglers take him to a gas station, where they meet another man in the network. He puts Enrique with four immigrant men being routed to Orlando, Florida. They stay overnight in Houston, and at midday, Enrique leaves Texas in a green van. 5 days later, Lourdes's boyfriend gets time off from work to drive to Orlando, where Enrique has been staying with other immigrants and waiting for him to arrive. Her boyfriend is handsome, with broad shoulders, graying temples, and a mustache. Enrique recognizes him from a video his Uncle Carlos brought back from a visit. "Are you Lourdes's son?" the boyfriend asks. Enrique nods. "Let's go." They say little in the car, and Enrique falls asleep. By 8 a.m. on May 28th, Enrique is in North Carolina. He awakens to tires crossing highway seams. Click, 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 click. "Are we lost?" he asks. "Are you sure we aren't lost? Do you know where we are going?" "We're almost there." They are moving fast through pines and elms, past billboards and fields, yellow lilies and purple lilacs. The road is freshly paved. It goes over a bridge and passes cattle pastures with large rolls of hay. On both sides are wealthy subdivisions, then railroad tracks. Finally, at the end of a short gravel street, some house trailers. One is beige. Built in the 1950s, it has white metal awnings and is framed in tall green trees. At 10 a.m., after more than 12,000 miles, 122 days, and seven futile attempts to get to his mother, Enrique, 11 years older than when she left him behind, bounds from the back seat of the car and up five faded redwood steps, and swings open the white door of the mobile home. To the left, beyond a tiny living room with dark wooden beams, sits a girl with shoulder-length black hair and curly bangs. She is at the kitchen table eating breakfast. He remembers a picture of her. Her name is Diana. She is 9 now. Enrique leans over and kisses the girl on the cheek. "Are you my brother?" He nods. "Where's my mother? Where's my mother?" She motions past the kitchen to the far end of the trailer. Enrique runs. His feet zigzag down two narrow, brown-paneled hallways. He opens a door. Inside, the room is cluttered, dark. On a queen-size bed, under a window draped with lace curtains, his mother is asleep. He jumps squarely onto the bed next to her. He gives her a hug, then a kiss. "You're here, mi hijo." "I'm here," he says. A twist. The Odyssey, an epic poem about a hero's journey home from war, ends with reunion and peace. The Grapes of Wrath, the classic novel about the Dust Bowl and the migration of Oklahoma farmers to California, ends with death and a glimmer of renewed life. Enrique's journey is not fiction, and its conclusion is more complex and less dramatic. But it ends with a twist worthy of O. Henry. Children like Enrique dream of finding their mothers and living happily ever after. For weeks, perhaps months, these children and their mothers cling to romanticized notions of how they should feel toward each other. Then reality intrudes. The children show resentment because they were left behind. They remember broken promises to return and accuse their mothers of lying. They complain that their mothers work too hard to give them the attention they have been missing. In extreme cases, they find love and esteem elsewhere, by getting pregnant, marrying early, or joining gangs. Some are surprised to discover entire new families in the United States. A stepfather, stepbrothers, and stepsisters. Jealousies grow. Stepchildren call the new arrivals mojados, or wetbacks, and to gain power over their new siblings, threaten to summon U.S. immigration authorities. The mothers, for their part, demand respect for their sacrifice, leaving their children for the children's sake. Some have been lonely and worked hard to support themselves, to pay off their own smuggling debts, and save money to send home. When their children say, "You abandoned me," they respond by hauling out tall stacks of money transfer receipts. They think their children are ungrateful and bristle at the independence they show. The same independence that helped the children survive their journeys north. In time, mothers and children discover they hardly know each other. At first, neither Enrique nor Lourdes cries. He kisses her again. She holds him tightly. He has played this out in his mind 1,000 times. It is just as he thought it would be. All day they talk. He tells her about his travels, the clubbing on top of a train, leaping off to save his life, the hunger, thirst, and fear. He has lost 28 pounds and is down to 107. She cooks rice, beans, and fried pork. He sits at the table and eats. The boy she last saw when he was in kindergarten is taller than she is. He has her nose, her round face, her eyes, her curly hair. Lourdes has 3 children, but Enrique is special. He is her only son. "Look, Mom, look what I put here." He pulls up his shirt. She sees a tattoo. "Enrique Lourdes," it says across his chest. His mother winces. "Tattoos," she says, "are for delinquents, for people in jail." "I'm going to tell you, son, I don't like this." She pauses. "But at least if you had to get a tattoo, you remembered me." "I've always remembered you." He tells her about Honduras, how he stole his aunt's jewelry to pay drug debts, how he sold the shoes and clothes she sent to buy glue, how he wanted to get away from drugs, how he ached to be with her. Finally, Lourdes cries. She asks about Belki, her daughter in Honduras, her own mother, and the deaths of 2 of her brothers. Then she stops. She feels too guilty to go on. The trailer is awash in guilt. 8 people live here. Several have left their children behind. All they have is pictures. Lourdes's boyfriend has 2 sons in Honduras. He has not seen them in 5 years. One of the boyfriend's cousins left behind a wife and son, 2 months old. He has not seen them in 2 years. Another cousin and her husband left behind a 4-year-old daughter. The husband has never seen the daughter. His wife was pregnant when he left. She calls every 2 weeks and vows to return to Honduras in 1 year if she hasn't been able to bring their daughter north. "The most important thing is love. Not losing that," she says. 3 pictures of the little girl in a pink shirt and pigtails stand as a constant reminder near a television in a corner. Enrique likes the people in the trailer, especially his mother's boyfriend. He could be a better father than his own dad, who abandoned him 10 years ago to start another family. In Honduras, Enrique's grandmother walks next door to talk to Enrique's girlfriend, Maria Isabel. She has news. Enrique made it. Maria Isabel wails. "He's not coming back." She locks herself in her bedroom and cries for 2 hours. For the next few months, Maria Isabel spends hours at a time silently sitting on a rock in front of her Aunt Gloria's house. At night, Gloria hears Maria Isabel sobbing. Gloria's daughter tries to console Maria Isabel. At least now, the daughter tells her, she's sure Enrique is alive. Cheer up, she says. He's there. He'll send money. If he'd stayed, you would have both died of hunger. But Maria Isabel, normally always giggling, is serious and sad. Belki, too, is depressed. She stops talking. In the morning, she cries before facing each new day. She longs to be with her mother. Maybe, she tells herself, she should have gone with her brother, taken the risk. Now both Enrique and Diana are with her mother. Now I'm the only one left here, she tells her aunt, Rosa Amalia. 3 days after Enrique arrives, Lourdes's boyfriend helps him find work as a painter. He earns $7 an hour. Within a week, he is promoted to sander, making $9.50. With his first paycheck, he offers to pick up $50 of the food bill. He buys Diana a gift, a pair of pink sandals for $5.97. He sends money to Belki and to his girlfriend in Honduras. Lourdes brags to her friends. This is my son. Look at him. He's so big. It's a miracle he's here. Whenever he leaves the house, she hugs him. When she comes home from work, they sit on the couch, watching her favorite soap opera, with her hand resting on his arm. Each Sunday, they go shopping together to buy enough food to last the week. Lourdes cooks for Enrique, and he begins to put on weight. Over time, though, they realize they are strangers. Neither knows the other's likes or dislikes. At a grocery store, Lourdes reaches for bottles of Coke. Enrique says he does not drink Coke, only Sprite. He plans to work and make money. She wants him to study English, learn a profession. At first, he is quiet and shy. That begins to change. He goes to a pool hall without asking permission. She becomes upset. Occasionally, he uses profanities. She tells him not to. No, Mommy, he says. No one is going to change me. Well, you'll have to change. If not, we'll have problems. I want a son who, when I say to do something, he says, okay. You can't tell me what to do. The clash culminates several weeks after Enrique arrives, when Maria Isabel telephones Collect, and her call is rejected because some of the immigrants in the trailer do not know who she is. That was right, Lourdes says. They cannot afford Collect calls from just anyone. Enrique flares and begins to pack. Enrique says, who are you to me? I don't even know you. Lourdes is enraged. She grabs him by his arm and pulls him into the privacy of her bedroom. You will respect me, she yells. I am your mother. Lourdes blames Enrique's grandmother, Maria. She spoiled the boy and let him run amok. Lourdes is determined to impose discipline on her son. She walks up behind him and spanks him hard on his buttocks several times. You have no right to hit me. You didn't raise me. He tells her that only his grandmother Maria, who raised him, has that right. Lourdes disagrees. I sent money. I supported you. That is raising you. Enrique locks himself in the bathroom and sobs. He throws about anything he can find, toothpaste, shampoo, a perfume bottle. Diana rushes into the bedroom crying. Enrique storms out of the house. Lourdes's boyfriend and his cousin try to calm her. They cruise the streets, trying to find Enrique. Enrique hides behind a small Baptist church 2 miles away. He sleeps in the graveyard behind the church, between the headstones. Lourdes stays up most of the night. What she worries will be her future with Enrique. The next afternoon, however, their love prevails. Enrique returns home and apologizes to his mother. He tells her he loves her. He comforts her with a little white lie. He tells her he spent the night safely sleeping in her car. They share hugs and kisses. That night, they watch soap operas together on the living room sofa. As they sit side by side, Lourdes can feel her son's love. Enrique and his mother are conciliatory at last. More than that, they might be joined by Maria Isabel. One day, Enrique phones Honduras. Maria Isabel is pregnant, as he suspected before he left. On November 2, 2000, she gives birth to their daughter. She and Enrique name the baby Catherine Jasmine. The baby looks like him. She has his mouth, his nose, his eyes. An aunt urges Maria Isabel to go to the United States alone. The aunt promises to take care of the baby. If I have the opportunity, I'll go, Maria Isabel says. I'll leave my baby behind. Enrique agrees. We'll have to leave the baby behind.